On Tech News Today, the FCC chairman proposes new rules that critics say ends net neutrality in the United States. The big tech companies unite to prevent the next Heartbleed, and Facebook acquires a fitness tracker and launches a breaking news service. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, April 24th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. And by RingCentral, the cloud-based phone system we use here at Twit, and it just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs. RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Jill Duffy. Jill is a writer and software analyst who works at PCMag.com, and she's the author of Get Organized, How to Clean Up Your Messy Digital Life. Welcome, Jill.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it was great having you in studio last week. I hope you enjoyed this part of Northern California while you're here.
I did. Now I'm back in New York, but excited about the headlines today.
All right. Well, let's jump right into them, shall we? The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Tom Wheeler, plans to propose today new rules for internet service providers that critics say would end net neutrality in the United States. His proposal would allow content providers to pay ISPs for superior connections for that last mile connectivity to homes and businesses. Yet he defends the move, saying that they preserve net neutrality. Before I introduce our interview guest on this topic today, let's hear what presidential candidate Barack Obama promised in November 2007, speaking at Google's Silicon Valley headquarters.
I intend to work with you to write the next chapter in the story of American innovation. That's part of the reason why I'm running for president of the United States. To seize this moment, we have to ensure free and full exchange of information. And that starts with an open internet. I will take a backseat to no one in my commitment to network neutrality. Because once providers start to privilege some applications or websites over others, then the smaller voices get squeezed out and we all lose. The internet is perhaps the most open network in history, and we have to keep it that way.
Well, I certainly agree with that. With us to discuss this topic is Jason Abruzzese, reporter for Mashable. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks very much.
Now, can you give us a little background on how we got to where we are today? I mean, as I understand it, the United States had a functioning system for protecting net neutrality. Why are the rules for net neutrality being rewritten at this point?
Well, not too long ago, a court of appeals struck down our net neutrality rules that the FCC had written, saying that they went too far and were essentially, gave too much power to the FCC. They were told to rewrite the rules and that if they were, you know, resubmitted, that they could end up guaranteeing an open internet, what people know as net neutrality. What's being proposed today within the FCC is the newest version of those rules that they're hoping will stay within the law while also maintaining an open internet.
Now, this is a fairly complex issue when you get into the details, and there was a lot of news around Netflix and Comcast talking about peering arrangements. Now, what that's about is a point of origin for content such as Netflix connecting to the company like Comcast that's going to provide connectivity to end users. And that connection between the content origin and the internet service provider is something that is subject to things called peering agreements, where companies like Netflix can pay Comcast for faster connections. Those connections have to be paid for by somebody at some point. What we're talking about here today is what happens after Comcast, between Comcast and the end user. And that's where the rubber meets the road is in terms of net neutrality. The confusing thing about this news is that is the degree to which Tom Wheeler is saying that despite the fact that he's proposing the legality of companies to pay the internet service providers for better connectivity, essentially, while those who don't pay don't get better connectivity, he's saying that it still preserves net neutrality. Can you explain his position?
So it's important to remember that this is a type of regulation, what is being proposed, and that's one of the reasons that the court initially struck it down. What these new rules will propose is very similar to what the old rules had enforced, which includes the fact that you're not allowed to block anyone. So if there's a legal website, there's no way, or an ISP is not legally allowed to block anybody. So you can't require people to pay for access. There's a guaranteed minimum level of access for any website that wants to operate, whether it's a startup that you know you have out of your garage or if it's Netflix or ESPN.
So here's the part that really bugs me about this. I mean, that's part of what he says makes this fair and preserving of net neutrality, which is what you just said. And in addition to that, there's a process for, you know, if there's some unfairness, somebody can, you know, appeal it or whatever, probably in the courts. What bugs me about this is that internet service providers now have an incentive under these rules, it seems to me, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, if you get paid when people provide you with a faster, better, more reliable connection, you have an incentive now to provide everybody else with a less reliable connection, right? Because you want to incentivize your customers to upgrade. It's like a freemium model almost. So with under net neutrality, if you're trying to compete with other companies to provide unfettered access, really good connections to other to high-speed content, such as, you know, coming from YouTube or Netflix or whatever, then you have an incentive to boost the performance of your network for everybody under net neutrality. Under these rules, it seems like that incentive is gone. You have an incentive to provide good connections for those who pay, and you have an incentive to provide bad connections for those who don't pay. Am I misreading this?
No, and that is one of the biggest concerns that people have about these new rules, is that the way in which they are written is not going to incentivize companies to invest broadly in their infrastructure, and that they will really only invest in areas that they find profitable. Under this model, you could theoretically say that only times where one company is going to pay for a better connection with us is a place that we're going to invest. It's also important to remember that at the same time, the FCC is trying to make sure that they use this phrase, and you're going to hear it a lot in the future, commercially reasonable. Remember that phrase, you're going to hear it all the time, because that's the key phrase here. The FCC is saying that any agreement that two companies come to, whether it's Comcast and Netflix, Time Warner Cable and Amazon, it has to be, quote unquote, commercially reasonable. That's going to be their test to make sure that any agreement they find doesn't harm the open internet, and also make sure to incentivize that companies invest in their infrastructure and, you know, improve the internet going forward.
Now, Jason, I wanted to play devil's advocate a little bit here and ask about, I think GigaOm wrote a counterpoint sort of saying that there are a lot of sites that don't require high streaming, high broadband to get their pages and their websites delivered. So in some ways, if you're not delivering video content, intensive graphics, things like this, maybe you don't need to pay for this high specialized service. Maybe it's actually in some smaller players' benefit to keep their pages optimized to be streamed over low quality broadband. What do you make of that?
We hope that that's how it turns out. That would be really the ideal scenario, in that this agreement basically means that companies are able to sign agreements that provide better service while providing a minimum level of service that any website that really needs to operate on a simple level will be able to have without paying any sort of fee. There's a lot of paranoia that companies are not going to, you know, pursue that course, and that what you're going to end up with is a very poor service for even the most basic website, while other companies, you know, prosper because they have the money to pay those fees.
Now, I also wanted to ask, is there any way that users will have sort of visibility into who's getting specialized treatment and who isn't?
Yeah, that's a very important question. So there's two parts to that answer. One is that transparency is going to be a big part of this. That was in the part of the original open internet rules. And the FCC says it's going to be enhanced by this new ruling. So hopefully we'll gain greater insight into how companies like a Comcast, like a Time Warner Cable, like a Google Fiber handle their network loads. That will allow us to make sure that they're not, giving particular favor to certain groups.
Now, Jason, you've seen the criticism on the social networks. It's been very loud, coming from all quarters. There seems to be a tsunami of criticism of this proposal, and not very much in the way of defense. The Guardian, for example, tweeted a few minutes ago that it axe murders net neutrality. That seems a bit extreme. But one of the charges is that essentially this is yet another case of something that has been repeated in the history of the United States over and over, which is that an industry emerges, call it the car industry. There's huge shakeouts, and you end up with a tiny number of companies that are very wealthy. Then they use their wealth to influence government to change the rules to advantage the big companies and disadvantage the smaller companies. And that's tragic because small companies is where innovation comes from. Is this a valid viewpoint of what's happening here? Is this a case where the people like Wheeler, who in fact comes from this industry, and it's a revolving door situation, where he's in government being influenced by big companies to provide a disadvantage to small companies who maybe can't afford to pay the internet service providers for that superior access?
You know, I think those concerns are warranted. Net neutrality has generally been regarded as a bright line. On one side, all traffic is created equal, it's treated equally, and that's how it needs to be. And there's a lot of people who feel that that is the way that the internet grew, and that's the only way it can go forward without becoming, you know, kind of what you discussed, a very tiered, situation that favors only those with the money to compete. I think that some of the reaction has been a little over the top. As I said earlier, the FCC was told by a court that the FCC didn't just, undo its own rules. It was told by a court that, you know, your rules right now are not legal. We're going to have to figure out a better way to do this. That's why they had to go back to the drawing board and rewrite these things. I think that, you know, concern about the role of lobbyists and the role of money in this situation is warranted, and people need to, you know, keep an eye on that. But I think we also have to realize that the FCC is in a tough spot here. They have a court on one side, and they have the open internet rules that they're trying to abide by on one side. They have to find a middle ground that's going to be the best for the internet, but that also is going to be legally viable going down the road.
Now, Jason, I have some, I'd like to interrupt this conversation quickly for some breaking news. We've just learned from Recode, from Liz Gaines and Kara Swisher, that Vic Gundotra, who's one of the top people at Google and is in charge of social for Google, including Google+, is leaving the company. He's leaving Google. And we're also learning that he will not be replaced by the number two person there, Bradley Horowitz. And they're reporting that he will be replaced by Dave Besbris, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. So once again, Vic Gundotra is leaving Google. Astonishing. Well, this is a fascinating topic, and I'd like to remind everybody listening that this is just a proposal. This proposal could be shot down, and it's something we'll be watching very carefully going forward. Jason, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and talking about this very complex and very important issue.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You can find Jason at Mashable.com and on Twitter at Jason. Let me spell it. That's Jason. Abbruzzese. Well, in a sec, we're going to tell you what's happening with the heartbleed-type problems out there on the internet. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace, which is the fantastic place to build a killer website. Squarespace has 25 beautiful templates for you to start your website with. You simply go in there, sign up, pick a template, and you are off and running, and you've got a website on the internet. Then you can go in and use their very easy-to-use tools to customize, tweak, and perfect your website to your heart's content. It's super easy to use, but if you want help, Squarespace has live chat and email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's very good. I've used it myself once or twice, and they always know what they're talking about and get back to you right away. E-commerce is now available on all subscription plan levels, so if you want to receive money for your nonprofit or for your business, you want to sell things, Squarespace is the place to do it, and it's inexpensive. Squarespace starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Squarespace is also mobile-ready, both on the maintenance side and also on the user side. People who see your website on a mobile device will see a beautiful site that's designed perfectly for a mobile device, and you don't have to do anything to make that happen. It just happens on Squarespace. And, of course, hosting is included. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT, and that'll get you 10% off the price, and it'll also show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, in the wake of the Heartbleed Flaw disaster, big technology companies are volunteering to fund central open source programs like OpenSSL. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, IBM, Cisco, Dell, Intel, you name it, a bunch of other companies as well have agreed to become founders of a new group called the Core Infrastructure Initiative. Clint Finley is a reporter for Wired, and he joins us to tell us about this development. Welcome, Clint.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. Now, what is the problem the Core Infrastructure Initiative is trying to solve? Is there a flaw in the concept of open source projects being run mainly by decentralized volunteers?
Well, I think the problem is that there are a lot of projects that are underfunded. A lot of things, Linux itself, the Chrome and Firefox web browsers, they have a lot of corporate backing. Sometimes they're developed in-house by companies like Google. But there are projects like OpenSSL that haven't received that sort of attention. And the Linux Foundation, the new Core Infrastructure Initiative, is hoping to address that by getting some funds into some of these less sexy, less known projects that a lot of people rely on.
Your Skype connection is a little flaky, so bear with us. Hopefully it'll improve magically on its own, and hopefully this isn't a net neutrality problem. Just kidding.
Yeah.
It clearly isn't. So, of course, the poster child for the problem that this is trying to solve is the Heartbleed bug. Can you tell us what went wrong there from the point of view of the initiative? I mean, clearly there weren't enough people working on it. What was the situation with the OpenSSL?
I think the big issue that, at least from the Linux Foundation's point of view, is that they only had one person working on the project full-time and then three volunteers, and that just wasn't enough eyes on the code. It wasn't enough security testing. So I think what they're hoping is to get more people working full-time on it, hire some people to do code audits and that sort of thing.
Now, the Linux Foundation is a nonprofit consortium group. Do you think this is the right group to be handling something like OpenSSL rather than maybe a security-focused group?
Well, the Linux Foundation is just providing funding, so hopefully they'll be hiring people who have a good security background to handle some of that sort of thing.
Now, the Linux Foundation executive director, Jim Zemlin, said something interesting, which is that he said that future backers, like right now, it's, you know, the Googles and the list of companies that I mentioned at the beginning of the story. But he said future backers could include governments and members of the financial services industry. That's probably okay, isn't it? Because essentially they're just writing checks.
Well, they're also choosing who gets those checks. But at the moment, what the foundation is saying, what the initiative's spokespeople are saying, is that they're going to be really hands-off in terms of how the projects are run. But we have to wait and see how true that actually is, whether they just choose who gets the funds and then write the checks, or if they start to add strings to how people can continue to get those funds. As far as I know, there hasn't been a lot of pressure from the Linux Foundation sponsors in terms of how Linux is developed, but the Linux kernel. But this is a, you know, a slightly different scenario, especially if you start bringing in government groups. But okay. Hopefully there'll be enough different people involved, enough different companies and interests involved that no one can really come in and no one company or organization or government will be able to come in and say, this is how it's going to have to be for you to keep getting your checks.
Now, there's been a lot of chatter on the social networks lately among journalists about the need for clearly explained stories. There seems to be have been a drift away from explaining stories very clearly so that everybody really understands what they're talking about. And your story on this issue was excellent in terms of explaining exactly what's going on. And I think it's an example of what people are calling for that we need a lot more of. So I really appreciate it. And I thank you for coming on Tech News today.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. I hope the Skype connection wasn't too bad.
It magically got better. So we love it when that happens. You can find Clint Finley at Clint Finley.com. That's K-L-I-N-T-F-I-N-L-E-Y.com. And also on Twitter at Clintron with a K. Well, Facebook has acquired the Helsinki, Finland-based company Protogeo Oy. The company makes a fitness app called Moves. It's one that I use myself. And Reed Albergati is a reporter who covers Facebook for The Wall Street Journal, and he's also the author of the book Wheelman. He's here to tell us about this acquisition. Welcome, Reed.
Thanks for having me.
From the user's perspective, Moves is a fitness app, but to Facebook, it's really a location and personal data harvesting engine, isn't it?
I mean, look, Facebook, the core of their business model is targeted advertising. So, of course, anything they do is going to have that sort of undercurrent of data gathering as a central tenant. But the company is saying that they're not going to commingle data between Moves and that the central Facebook business model. Now that could change in the future. This is a common thread when Facebook acquires companies like Instagram, WhatsApp. They say we're not going to use the data, but of course we know that could change in the future.
And it seems to me that it probably will change because this is some really sweet data from the perspective of providing, contextual advertising. Because, I mean, I use the app myself, and what's amazing about it from the user perspective and also from the data gathering perspective is you launch it and then you forget about it. And it will just run for weeks. And then, you know, you can, at the end of the day, after not even interacting with it in any way for a couple of weeks, you can say, huh, I wonder how far I walked today. And you open it up and it says, oh, you walked 1.2 miles, even tell you how many steps. It'll tell you how much time you bicycled and then tell you how much you ran. It knows the difference between those things. And also, crucially, it knows exactly where you went and how long you were there. It'll show you your whole day. You went to work, you were there for 6.5 hours, then you went to a bar, you drank yourself blind, and then you stumbled home at so-and-so time. And it's like it knows everything. And again, it runs constantly. It doesn't require the user's, much interaction from the user for that information to be harvested. So it's quite an astonishing app, and it's a really interesting acquisition, I think, for Facebook.
I think Mike, I just wanted to interject and explain a little bit more about how Moves work and what it does. So as you explained, Mike, it sort of collects data about where you are, how much you move. It's replicating the same kinds of services and functions that we see from wearable pedometers or activity monitors, as they're called. Except, of course, instead of having a separate component, it's all running on your phone. So the negative side is it drains your battery pretty quickly. And the other piece of content that I think Facebook is interested in, of course, is that anytime you use a fitness app, you have to send information about your height, weight, age, gender. So now, in conjunction with all of this very specific data about where you are, Facebook might be able to tell, or Moves would be able to tell, what kinds of people are in those places, what kinds of people travel to a big box store and stay there for 3 hours. So I think it's just important to know that there's additional information besides just where you are.
Let's also note that there are many, many apps out there that do the same thing, that are constantly tracking you, that really try to replace your Fitbit or your Jawbone Up band, these things you see everyone wearing to the gym or yoga class. But what makes Moves different, I think, is the technology that, like you said, allows them to automatically see what activity you're doing without you entering that information. So they know whether you're riding a bike, whether you're walking, whether you're running, whether you're on public transport. all that information could be very valuable. But I asked Facebook, you know, how do they know that? What's the algorithm behind that? And they actually have two patents pending for that exact thing. Now, I don't think other apps can do that in the same way. So that might be a smart business play. They don't have a patent, though, to tell whether you're drunk in the bar, as you know, as you noticed.
Reed, I wanted to ask Reed to just talk about how this acquisition is a little bit different from some of Facebook's other recent acquisitions that are really, really deeply rooted in social. Whereas Moves has some social aspects if you want to include them, but I don't really think of it as a social app. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think Facebook is looking into the future here. I mean, we know Apple's coming out with something like an iWatch that will have sensors in it and probably have an open API. I think that Facebook wants to jump on future internet ecosystems, whether it's a virtual reality goggles ecosystem. They acquired Oculus for $2 billion. Whether it's a mobile messaging ecosystem, they spent $19 billion on WhatsApp, the mobile messenger. I think here they're anticipating there's going to be a whole ecosystem of apps that track you using either these wearable devices or your mobile phone. And they want to be on top of that. They want to get in on the ground floor.
Well, now, Reed Albergati, Facebook also announced this morning the launch of a new news service called FB Newswire. Facebook called it a, quote, resource that will make it easier for journalists and newsrooms to find, share, and embed newsworthy content from Facebook. What else do we know about FB Newswire, Reed?
So Facebook has been in this battle with Twitter over news content. People tend to share this type of content on Twitter publicly. Journalists use Twitter as almost a news wire, but people on Facebook tend to talk about their personal lives. It's more of a personal tool. And Facebook actually wants people to post more publicly, to use it like they use Twitter. And I think this is an attempt by Facebook to really say, we're going to replace Twitter for journalists. We're going to curate all of this news that journalists need to see. And I think it's a really interesting play. If Facebook can be sort of a low maintenance version of Twitter where they do the work for us. I mean, right now we have to curate our own news on Twitter using apps like TweetDeck. I'm really interested to see whether it can work.
Now, sorry to keep interrupting the show for breaking news, but this is like a lot of breaking news during the show today. Amazon is testing its own delivery network, its own trucks, and this is going to enable delivering goods on the same day that you buy them. So less than one day delivery. That is astonishing. Now, this, of course, is powered by Storyful. What do you know about Storyful, Reed Albergati?
It was actually acquired by the parent company of the Wall Street Journal. So Storyful is actually, it's a way to verify news stories for journalists. And I think it was a really interesting acquisition for Dow Jones, for News Corp, I should say. And it's actually, Storyful is actually partnering here with Facebook. So full disclosure, it is owned by the parent company of my newspaper.
So it's an interesting model. They're relying on crowd-based posting of news stories. Then it sounds like they're probably going to be verifying the veracity of those stories using Storyful and then giving them to journalists so that journalists have a breaking news feed. Now, people can find this at facebook.com/FBNewsWire and also on Twitter. You can follow the Twitter account FBNewsWire. It's really a fascinating development, and you know, I guess they're sort of kind of competing with AP and Reuters. Not exactly, but it's an alternative source for journalists to get stories. So it's pretty interesting. So Reed Albergati, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today, telling us about both of these Facebook stories.
It's always fun to be on. Thanks for having me.
All right, thank you. You can find Reed Albergati at WSJ.com, of course, which is the Wall Street Journal's website, and on Twitter at Reed Albergati. Let me spell that, REEDALBERGOTTI. Well, in a sec, we're going to tell you about other Amazon rumors coming true, but first I want to tell you about RingCentral. RingCentral is a cloud-based phone system, and it happens to be the one that we use here at Twit. When Leo set up the studio here at Twit The last thing he wanted was a big, old, and busted PBX system in the basement. So it was just clear that RingCentral was the way to go because it's cloud central, zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain, and it was an excellent decision. And now RingCentral has launched Meetings. So in addition to everything we like about RingCentral, the voicemails through email, the sending and receiving of fax messages from smartphones, the auto receptionist who greets our callers, and so on, now, with Meetings, we can host face-to-face meetings in high def and share desktop or documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Very, very cool. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 a month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for TWIT listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number designated for listeners of Tech News Today, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. Well, Amazon introduced yesterday a long-rumored service called Amazon Prime Pantry. Amazon Prime members can get up to 45 pounds of groceries delivered for $6. That's right, you're buying groceries by the pound. At least the delivery is paid for by the pound. The service is now live in 48 states in the U.S. only. The $6 fee is in addition to the Prime membership fee. And Jill, this is a pretty interesting thing. Obviously, the problem that Amazon is trying to solve here is that when you buy something from Amazon, you're like, oh, I'm going to get a book, or maybe I'll get a couple of items. People don't do real shopping on Amazon. You don't do the same kind of shopping you'd do at Costco or the grocery store, where you buy a whole carload of stuff. You just buy one or two things, and they're trying to change that.
Well, I think they already are changing that, but kind of in a sneaky way. Amazon owns soap.com, and they also own diapers.com. Diapers.com and soap.com carry a whole lot more than just soap and diapers. They really stock up on all kinds of household items. So people who buy things like paper towels, laundry detergent, cooking oil, all that stuff that might add up to a good 45 pounds worth of home items, is already being sold and is already completely covered by those two sites. I think Amazon here is just kind of rolling it into their main site, this strength that they already have with soap.com and diapers.com, and offering it at a price that's a little bit better for their Prime members to give more weight to that Prime membership. That's my take on it.
Interesting. Well, we reported earlier in the year a whole bunch of rumors, and it sounds like one by one they're all coming true, including this one. You know, they deliver everything from water to paper towels. What's funny about that is water weighs, what, about 8 pounds a gallon. So you could probably get five or so gallons of water delivered. Or you could probably get an entire truckload of toilet paper, right? How much does that weigh? So, again, this is kind of a crazy deal, charging delivery by the pound, and we'll see how they do with it. Well, we told you earlier this month that Google would sell Google Glass to anyone on April 15th only. But some Redditors have discovered that the Google Glass order page is still up and running, and that anyone can still order Google Glass. Right now, you can go order Google Glass. Who knew? All you need is $1,500 and a little bit of courage to wear it around. Well, in other news, Microsoft has not announced the rumored Surface Mini tablet, but accessories for the device are already on sale on Amazon.com. The seller is the Chinese electronics store Vostrostone, and if the listing is accurate, the Surface Mini could launch in May. Well, that's our news for today. Keep a lookout today for earnings reports from Microsoft, Verizon, Pandora, and Amazon.com itself. Jill, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today again as our guest co-anchor.
Thank you for having me, Mike. I love doing it.
All right, wonderful. And where can people find your work?
You can find me on PCMag.com. I have a weekly column every Monday called Get Organized. And you can also find me on Twitter at Jill E. Duffy.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. If you like breaking news, and I know you do, you can follow our breaking news feed. That's the Twitter account, Twit News. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email to TNT@twit.tv, or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.